Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first matter today, 2022-0595, in the matter of Scott Fetzer Company versus the American Home Assurance Company, Incorporated. For the appellant, Mr. Garish. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And what I was hoping to do today, Jeff Garish on behalf of Travelers, I apologize. What I was hoping to do today is spend just a minute or two on background and context, then give two reasons why we think Section 193 applies and Section 145 doesn't, one of which will take a little bit of unpacking. And then if I have time, I want to address two specific points in Scott Fetzer's response brief. This is an insurance contract dispute in which it is unknown whether insurance contracts even exist. Travelers has tried for many, many years to get Scott Fetzer to produce policies or prove that they exist, and it has never done so. And so when Scott Fetzer says that Travelers hasn't taken a coverage position for more than 30 years, what it's talking about is the fact that Travelers has never denied coverage, despite Scott Fetzer never even proving that policies exist. In fact, Travelers even paid a settlement. What we do know is that if the policies were issued, they were issued to Kingston Products in Indiana, which was an Indiana-based company. We also know that they insured Indiana sites and at least one Michigan site, the Bronson, Michigan site, out of which this particular coverage dispute arises. There is no connection to Ohio except for the fact that Scott Fetzer is located in Ohio and acquired Kingston Products many years after the contamination occurred and after the policies were issued. Now, the context in which the dispute before the court arises is Scott Fetzer is trying to obtain discovery of Travelers documents that are privileged under the attorney-client privilege. The only reason it's able to do so is Ohio has a unique law by which an insured is entitled to privileged documents in a bad faith claim. And there's a wrinkle here. The bad faith claim has actually been bifurcated and is not even in litigation. But because Scott Fetzer merely alleged bad faith and because the trial court didn't stay discovery on it, Scott Fetzer is trying to use those privileged documents in order to prove coverage. Now, the specific dispute that gives rise, obviously, to a very important choice of law question, and our position is that either Indiana law or Michigan law applies, probably Indiana law, because we think Section 193 applies and Section 145 does not. The court has adopted the restatement. Section 145 is the generally applicable section that governs tort actions generally. Section 188 governs contract actions generally. Section 193 is specific to the insurance contract context. And there's two reasons why 193 applies in our view. Number one, it applies on its plain terms. Contrary to Scott Fetzer's position, 193 is not limited to claims sounding in contract. It extends to any claims based on rights created by an insurance contract, and our position is a bad faith claim is based on rights that would not exist except in the context of an insurance contract, and therefore they're based on the insurance contract. Now, the second reason why 193 applies is seen when you dig into the reasons behind the factors, behind the choice of law considerations. And this is a very important point. We briefed it, but I kind of want to unpack it a little bit today. In Ohayon, which is probably this court's seminal opinion and choice of law.
I guess what I don't understand is, even if 193 applies, why, under the last clause, why wouldn't Ohio be a state that has a more significant relationship under the principles stated in Section 6?
Well, because all the claims arise out of insurance contracts that were entered into in Indiana.
But, you know, in this case, we're talking about, you know, decades-old policies. We're talking about conduct that has nothing to do with the state of the insured risk. You have someone who in Ohio, why wouldn't Section 6, you know, why wouldn't the second clause get you the same place, regardless of which provision applies?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I think the main Section 6 factor principle deals with the ease and determination of determining which state's law applies. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the only reason that Ohio has any interest is because Scott Fetzer, an Ohio-based company, acquired these contracts. Scott Fetzer could be purchased tomorrow by a company headquartered in Texas. If that were to happen, then does it make sense for Texas supply? And then if it's acquired by a company in California?
Well, in this case, though, the tort that we're talking about, the bad faith claim, allegedly, you know, was made to someone in Ohio. So that would be different if someone, you know, if someone later on acquired Scott Fetzer.
But the point is, under Principle 6, ease and determination of which state's law applies is one of the most important factors. And if you apply the state of the law, which is the principal location of the insured risk, to any claim, we know from the outset that Indiana law is going to apply throughout the history of any relations or causes of action that arise out of that.
That's having to do with breach of contract, though, isn't it? Not bad faith.
Well, not necessarily, because again, here's the point that I wanted to get to with Ohayon. What Ohayon said, there's an interesting passage in Ohayon that both Ms. Leffler and I quoted in our brief. On page 17 of her brief, on page 12 of mine, we quoted the same passage in Ohayon. In that passage, this court in Ohayon gave the reason why there are different choice of law considerations for the contract context versus the tort context. And the reason is because parties to a contract have justified expectations as to which state's law will apply, regardless of what is the nature of the cause of action that arises out of it. That's what Ohayon said. That is a very important point in the restatement. In fact, restatement 188, comment B, specifically says, and I'm quoting, "Protection of the justified expectations of the parties is the basic policy underlying the field of contracts."
Even if you're correct on that, okay, aren't we bound by precedent that bad faith in Ohio is a tort? Or would we have to not overrule all those cases?
No, of course, Your Honor, you're bound by those cases. But the mere fact that bad faith is a tort doesn't necessarily mean that 145 applies. 193 should apply irrespective of whether it's a contract or a tort, because these are contracting parties. And as Ohayon said, unlike contracting parties, parties to a tort don't have pre-existing justified expectations.
In many of those cases, though, there were contracting parties.
In
cases setting the precedent of a bad faith being a tort.
But none of those cases have said which choice of law factor applies. As Scott Fetzer concedes, this is an issue of first impression, and 193 is not limited to cases sounding in contract. That's the point. And the parties have justified expectations by virtue of the fact that they're contracting parties.
I thought you said there is no contract. At least as of
well, the premise of this lawsuit is that there is. We're assuming that there is. If there's not, they have no cause of action in contract or in bad faith. We assume arguendo that insurance contracts exist, and if that's the case, we know that they were issued and tethered to Indiana to insure primarily Indiana sites and the Michigan site. But I wanted to try to give one more reason, if I can, Justice DeWine, to your question, which is another point that Scott Fetzer makes in its brief, is that Ohio can apply different states' law to different issues. That is not at all clear, I would submit. The doctrine that they're citing is called depicage. This court has never adopted depicage, which is the doctrine that allows different states' laws to apply to different issues. There is one Ohio Court of Appeals case from the 10th District that adopted it, Sample versus Zenos Christian, which is 139 Northeast 2nd, Northeast 3rd, 978. But even that case, the court says depicage should be used with caution because of the problems that can arise from it. And Michigan and Indiana have not adopted depicage, and we would urge this court not to do so either, and instead apply Indiana law both to all the issues, contract disputes and...
I'm sorry. I thought these sites were in Michigan.
They are. It is in Michigan.
So if you decide the insured risk, why would it be Indiana, not Michigan?
Because 193 points to the state, which is the principal location of the insured risk at the time of contracting. It could potentially be Michigan, depending on how significant that site was to the contracting parties. Candidly, Your Honor, we don't know because we don't have contracts to look at. But I think it's safe to assume that Indiana was probably viewed as the principal location of the insured risk at the time of contracting, because that's where Kingston was headquartered, and it had at least several Indiana sites. In fact, the settlement that Travelers paid concerned several Indiana sites. If it
So the insured risk goes to not where actually the injury occurred that you're seeking to collect, but what the overall insured the center of that is, that the test?
Well, yeah, 193 applies to it points to the law that's the principal location of the insured risk at the time of contracting. So if you have an Indiana-based contract with an Indiana company with Indiana sites and a site in Michigan, probably Indiana law applies given those connections to Indiana.
I'm trying to recall, did you argue the Indiana piece in your brief?
Your Honor, we didn't, not in much detail. What we said in our brief is that either Indiana law or Michigan law applies, which is why I wanted to clarify this today for Your Honors. It probably doesn't matter, which is why we didn't focus on it in the briefing, because as long as Ohio law doesn't apply, which we think is the case, then they can't get these privileged documents, because Indiana doesn't allow this and neither does Michigan law.
But I mean, that really applies to breach of contract and not to the tort of bad faith. And I mean, we've got our case law in Ohio that specifically says what the intention of the parties was kind of goes out the window when it's a tort, because when you commit a tort, you sort of blow through any of those intentions.
As a general rule, that's true. But I would submit that a different rule is called for when you have a tort committed within contracting parties, because it's the existence of the contract that gives the parties the justified expectations under Ohan. In fact, Ohan specifically said, after explaining why justified expectations exist in the contract setting, this court in Ohan said this, Unlike a contracting party, a negligent tortfeasor acts without conscious disregard for, your point, Your Honor, the particular law to be applied to that contract. Here we have contracting parties. That's the point. When you have contracting parties, they have justified expectations, or at least they might.
But isn't this just a common law tort? So it doesn't matter about... It comes in the context of a contract, but the actual alleged injury is a common law tort.
The fact that the parties are contracting parties is what makes 193 applicable. 193 envisions parties having a justified expectation that the law that is the principal location of the insured risk is the law that governs. And again, 193 isn't limited to actions sounding in contract. There's nothing in there that says it's limited to contracts.
I understand, but if one party just actually acts outside the contract, bad faith, why is the other party who's aggrieved bound to act within the contract?
Well, that's a question that goes to the substance, and I guess in terms of choice of law, I think a different analysis applies, which is that...
I'm not assigning blame. I'm just saying these are the allegations. So why is that one party procedurally bound to live within that contract when the other party is alleged to have gone outside the contract and done what amounts to, under our case law, is committed tort?
Well, when Scott Fetzer applied Kingston Products, it essentially stepped into their shoes. Kingston Products was an Indiana-based company that entered into insurance contracts in Indiana. And under 193, we think it applies whether the subsequent cause of action arises in tort or contract.
And can you address the meeting in Cleveland that was alleged to have occurred? It's dealt with in the transcripts in the brief, in the briefs?
Well, I don't know specifically what relevance that has to the choice of law considerations. Their argument is that consequences of the tort affected them because they're in Ohio, and I'm assuming they would point to the Cleveland meeting as part of that. But again, the tort itself, if you're going to go down this road, was committed by Travelers, which is located in Connecticut. And this is the problem with applying a different state's law to tort claims than for contract, when all the claims arise out of a contract that's centered in Indiana.
I understand, but looking at the factors, I don't know if you're going to apply 145, I suppose, but you've got the tort resulted from a communication saying, and so if there's evidence in the record that communications occurred in Cleveland at an attorney's office, isn't that something we should pay attention to?
It's not relevant under Section 193. And again, the vicissitudes of the various activity that might come up in the context of a tort is less important, particularly under the Section 6 principles, including ease and determination, that are the central to Section 193. Again, they could end up they could have had a meeting in New York. If they happen to have a meeting in New York, does that mean New York law should apply? It's too arbitrary, we would submit.
Well, it's a number of factors. It wouldn't just be that solely.
That's correct, okay. Which also complicates the analysis further.
I'll say.
I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Loeffler, good morning.
Good morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I'd like to start out by saying to this court that you already have all of the tools that you need in order to make this decision, because this court has already issued rulings that bear on this very question. This is an issue of first impression, and it hasn't been addressed by any court in Ohio, but it's one of those rare circumstances that the answer can be derived by simply looking at the prior precedent of this court. The place that I would start is Ohayon. Ohayon tells us, and I agree about everything that my esteemed counsel, opposing counsel said about what Ohayon said, but what it says at the very beginning is that the first step in a choice of law analysis is to classify the cause of action as either a tort or a contract, and that's how you're going to determine which choice of law principle applies. There's no dispute that Section 145 applies to tort claims, and there's no dispute, nor can there be, that bad faith is a tort. And this court said that in Hoskins, and it said it over and over again in multiple cases. So the courts below correctly held that since 145 applies to torts, and bad faith is a tort, Section 145 applies to the tort of bad faith. And the analysis is as simple as that. I wanted to address just very briefly a couple of the factual assertions made by opposing counsel. He talked a bit about the existence or non-existence of lost policies. And what the record reflects is that there is evidence of lost policies. There are declaration pages for several of the policies. The record also reflects that though Scott Fetzer asked for 33 years for Travelers to provide information that it might have in its files about lost policies, it wasn't until this lawsuit was filed in 2019 that Travelers provided evidence that it had actually reinsured the policies that it now contends do not exist. That is a fundamental premise, frankly, of our bad faith claim. It is a claim that relates to bad faith claims handling and what Travelers did or did not do in its communications that were directed at an Ohio policyholder over the span of 33 years.
But counsel, if those representations had happened, as opposing counsel said, in numerous places, in New York and in Texas and Connecticut and Michigan, then would any of those states' laws apply?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that they would. And here's why. Because we start with the premise that bad faith is a tort, so we are in 145. Okay. And 145 is looking at the state that has the most significant interest in the occurrence and in the parties. And there's four factors there. But what the restatement comments say, and this court has said, is that the most important factor is the place where the injury occurred. And that's to your point, Justice Brenner, that States have an interest in protecting their own citizens. The parties do not have any sort of reasonable or justified expectation that their contract rights are going to be protected when they're acting tortiously. And the restatement will focus on the location of the injury as the most important factor in determining. So under that circumstances, even if the communications occurred in Connecticut, Texas, New York, I would say that Ohio law would still clearly apply.
So if as the council gave an example, Scott Fetzer were to be sold to a company in Oklahoma, would Ohio law still apply to this claim?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that it would, because the bad faith conduct that we are alleging occurred prior to 2019.
Thank you.
Ms. Loeffler.
Go ahead.
Ms. Loeffler, the fact that Travelers continued to renew, well, they were originally Aetna policies, but the Travelers continued to renew the policies, you're saying the bad faith arises from the company saying, well, we don't have these policies, but yet they were renewing them?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was unclear. I'm saying that Travelers' bad faith here arises from the fact that in 1986, Scott Fetzer placed Travelers on notice. And at that moment in time, Travelers has an obligation imposed by this court and imposed in Ohio by law to process and investigate Scott Fetzer's claim in good faith. And I've looked at these documents. I won't bore you with all of them, but what I can tell you is that for a period of 33 years, Scott Fetzer would reach out to Travelers. Travelers would ask for more information. We'd provide it. They'd switch adjusters. It would happen all over again. We'd ask if there was evidence of lost policies. We wouldn't get responses to that. And it wasn't until we filed the lawsuit that we finally received information that suggests, and look, I'm going to have to prove it, right? Lost policies is something that happens, especially when you have decades old. These policies are from the 1940s. It's not shocking that they're hard to find. But I'll have to prove my case, but this is evidence that to which I was entitled. So the basis of our claim isn't that they were renewing. The basis of our claim is that starting in 1986, they had an obligation to fairly investigate this claim, and they didn't. And they did not. And they did not timely investigate it, and they did not timely convey their coverage determination. And frankly, that this was an exercise in delay.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Your esteemed colleague's argument that 193 applies tort or contract. What do you say?
I say no.
Why?
All right, I say no for multiple reasons. I say no because 193 applies only to rights created by the contract, and I know that bad faith is not a right created by a contract. I know it's not a right created by a contract because this court has said unequivocally it's created by operation of law. I know it's not a right created by a contract because this court and the lower courts have said over and over again that it exists independently of a breach of contract claim. Meaning, you can have a bad faith claim for claims handling in the state of Ohio even if there is no breach of contract. That couldn't be true if this was a right created by the contract.
But whether there's bad faith or not does depend on whether there's a contract.
So the contract creates the relationship. That's correct. The contract creates the relationship. But the right to be treated in good faith is not created by the contract. I think one of the most easy ways, it's kind of a simple way to look at it, but if it was a right that was created by the contract, the parties could change it. And I don't think anybody in this room would argue that an insurer could contract around its obligations of good faith. It can't, because it's a legal duty. I'm
Counsel,
so sorry.
What would be an example of someone who acted in bad faith, committed the tort of bad faith, but the contract was not breached, as you just mentioned?
These exact circumstances that we have in front of the court right now. Really, I always think of there are three types of bad faith in Ohio.
Wouldn't the right to have something investigated be within the contract?
It's not. that does not appear in the contract. The obligation to perform an investigation and handle the claim in good faith, that's not in the contract. And it has been courts like this court that have imposed these legal obligations on the insurers that have afforded those protections to policyholders in this state and others.
So a big part of what's going on here is that your adversary is concerned that you're going to ask for privilege, obtain privileged documents in the bad faith action, and then use them on the merits. Are there procedures in place to stop that?
Absolutely.
This is a very odd case where the court did not stay the bad faith claim.
Absolutely, Your Honor, there are. And that was actually one of the factual points I wanted to point out, too. We are no longer talking about a mere allegation of bad faith, because what the Ohio legislature did in 2317-02A2, where it adopted this court's decision, adopted and modified this court's decision in Boone, is it confirmed that it is the public policy of this state that we care so deeply about the tort of bad faith that we're going to allow some limited discovery into privileged documents. The way that that works is that the trial court here had to perform a two-step analysis. They first had to confirm that there's a prima facie case of bad faith. I've given you some facts here this morning as to why I think we have a prima facie case of bad faith. The second thing the trial court has to do is do an in-camera review of the documents. And I want to make sure that we're on the same page. Scott Fetzer asked for 47 documents. That's how many documents it identified. And the trial court has identified 20, which the magistrate, specifically said could bear on Travelers' bad faith conduct and its attempt to locate evidence regarding these lost policies. That's all we're getting. That's what we're looking at. So to your question as to whether does it go to
My question was, are there anything that prevents you from using those documents?
Sure.
Merits.
What would prevent me from using the documents on the merits is that they're not necessarily relevant to my breach of contract case. So my breach of contract case.
But that really wasn't my question. Is there anything in place that prevents you from doing that?
To use the privileged documents I'm not permitted to try my bad faith case.
I understand that, but is there anything in the court's order that precludes you from using these documents on the merits of the claim?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
But we as an appeals court, the second appeals court to look at this, really can't get to what the trial court did or didn't do, and it's in-camera inspection, because neither the Court of Appeals nor we have those documents in the record, correct?
That's correct, and I haven't seen them either. So I don't know if they bear at all on the coverage case or whether they bear solely on bad faith.
Counselor, if we disagree with the 8th District's analysis about the choice of law, then what happens?
Well, I think the question asked earlier about how 193 would work in these circumstances is absolutely correct. So I think that under 193, if 193 were to apply, we know that what it says is that the location of the insured risk itself is not necessarily dispositive. With respect to the particular issue, some other state has a more significant relationship. And I think when you're looking at this particular issue of bad faith, Ohio has a substantially more significant relationship.
It does, but if we were to disagree with the 8th District's analysis and we were to reverse, would it then be Michigan's law that applies?
So I don't think any of the lower courts have made, until this morning, Travelers had not taken a position as to whether or not, what state's law would apply under a 193 analysis, so I don't believe any decision on that has yet been made. However, I would present that I believe that this court could affirm under 193 based on the record if it's going to affirm that Ohio law is going to apply.
Okay.
Do you, if we were to think that a different law applied, do you need the opportunity to brief the Indiana versus Michigan, or is it really apples to apples, just whatever, whether it's Golden Delicious or regular?
I will say we haven't briefed it yet, but from what I know from a very high level, it is definitely not apples to apples between the two states. Bad faith law. I'd like to talk just briefly about the purpose of the contract provisions, because this came up in some of the questions as well. The contract rationale is designed to protect the justifiable expectations of this party. But as you pointed out, there are no justified expectations when we're talking about torts. And this court said that in Ohayon. The tort rules, however, usually focus on the place of injury, and that's because the courts want to protect persons who cause injury in a state should not ordinarily be able to escape liabilities imposed by the local law of that state on account of the injury. So in our view, the rationale behind the contract and tort distinctions in the restatement favor the application of the tort rule. I'd also point out that 193 is not a catch-all insurance provision that's found in some separate chapter of the restatement. The restatement is set up to make that classification easy for litigants like me. They have a chapter on torts and they have a chapter on contracts. Section 193 falls within the chapter on contracts, and it applies solely to rights created by a contract, which, as we've discussed here this morning, there is significant case law and jurisprudence from this court and others in the state that this does not involve a right created by a contract.
So you're saying that the concept of the tort is bigger than the concept of everything insurance is in 193?
Yes. So I think if I were to package it, I would say Travelers is suggesting that the relationship matters more than the classification. And I would say that kind of turns the restatement rules on their head. Because the restatement in this court, you start with the classification. Is it a tort or is it a contract? But the relationship matters. It's not that the relationship is immaterial. And even if we're in the tort world and we're in 145, 145 makes very clear twice that the first thing we're going to look at, the overriding principle, is which state has the most significant relationship to the occurrence and the parties. And one of the factors is the place where the relationship, if any, is centered. So the tort rule itself contemplates that there can be a pre-existing relationship between the parties. The fact of that relationship, the fact that the relationship began with a contract, doesn't change the inherent nature that this is a tort.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time, but I'll let you wrap up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I think if the court finds that 193 applies, you cannot affirm, because there would need to be a remand to determine how it applies. And the only other point I'd like to make in response to Justice DeWine's early question, another reason why Ohio doesn't have a greater interest is found in the unique context of this case, where the trial judge refused to stay discovery. Nothing in Boone supports allowing them to obtain privileged documents in order to prove coverage, which is exactly what they're trying to do.
But Counselor, didn't the court inspect the documents in camera?
Yes. And there was an argument about whether documents are privileged or not, but they shouldn't be allowed to take any discovery on the bad faith claim under Boone. Boone specifically said that a court should stay discovery on a bad, should bifurcate and stay discovery on a bad faith claim in this setting so that they're not entitled to get these privileged documents. And this 8th District specifically—
Is that issue even before us?
No, but it was brought up in the the only point, Your Honor, that's fair. The only point is, there's case law that says the trial judge abused his discretion by allowing this discovery, and that's why Ohio doesn't have any particular interest in having its law applied, because its law doesn't even fit this context.
A final quick question. Can we apply 193 if it's still a question of whether there is even a contract?
Well, yes, because the whole thing presumes, their whole claim, both tort and contract, assumes the existence of a contract.
But that's yet to be proven.
Correct. So, but the court still has to make a choice of law determination. Some states' law has to apply. So I think it's got to be assumed that there's a contract in order to do that. Otherwise, there's no basis for making a choice of law determination, which has to be made.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll receive a decision from the court.